The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
What I want to share with you tonight is an idea drawn from the Kabbalah. But before I share with you this idea for the Kabbalah, let me tell you a little bit about the Kabbalah, a little bit about myself and why I teach the Kabbalah. Kabbalah is very famous. Everybody knows about it. Everybody knows that Madonna is studying Kabbalah, right? And everybody knows her Hebrew name is?
Esther.
That's right. And I don't know if you all know about Bracha Sprinza, Britney Spears.
Oh.
Why is that funny? What? She doesn't look like a Bracha Sprinza. She looks like a Bracha Sprinza. Anyways. So everybody knows that the Kabbalah is very, very pop. But I started studying Kabbalah when it wasn't so popular. And the way it happened was I was 18, and I was my first time in Israel, my first time at the Western Wall, and a rabbinic-looking figure, a man with a long beard and a long black coat and long side curls. He was kind of long. Came up to me and said in a broken English, "I teach Kabbalah. You want to learn Kabbalah?" Now, what did I know about Kabbalah? All I knew about Kabbalah is what they told me in Hebrew school, which is forbidden to study Kabbalah until you're 40. Right? You all heard that, right? So a man comes up to me and offers to teach me Kabbalah. The first thing I think is, this is forbidden. So what do I say? Yes. Yes. Forbidden, finally, a way to do something Jewish and be a rebel at the same time. It was a perfect match for me. Okay. So the rabbi took me under his wings, and I still don't know why he actually came up to me, but he took me under his wings and started teaching me Kabbalah. I did not understand almost a word he said, A, because he taught it in Hebrew and I didn't know Hebrew, so that made it more mystical, but B, even when I finally got the Hebrew, then I had to work with the esoteric ideas, which is a whole other story. But now 30 years later, and 8 books later that I've written based on the Kabbalah or inspired by the Kabbalah, I have a little bit what I think I can share with you. What I want to share with you tonight is a little slice of my new book, The Secret Life of God, Discovering the Divine Within You. What makes me so excited about this book is recently a psychotherapist from Boston, not a Jewish fellow, was introduced to the book by a priest. And he got so excited about this book that he has all his clients reading the book. He sees 40 clients a week. He has a mental health center in Boston. And he's got 40 clients a week reading The Secret Life of God. He recently wrote an article for the American Psychotherapist Association about the therapeutic benefits of The Secret Life of God, and they've accepted it, right? So this is very, to me, this is very exciting that the mental health world will see how the ideas of Kabbalah, more importantly, the ideas rooted in Jewish mysticism, have a real benefit in understanding and appreciating and changing ourselves. Okay? So I'm going to share with you a little slice of an idea, right, from The Secret Life of God, and then the rest is commentary. If you want to know more, you'll know where to find it. You know, when I was a child, I had a lot of baggage with God. I think a lot of kids have baggage with God, but I had a lot of baggage with God. My mother is a survivor from the Holocaust, and my mother is not one that is talkative about the Holocaust because she doesn't want us, or she did not want us, she still does not want us, to have to deal with the pain, the horror of what happened to her family, to our people in the Holocaust. So growing up as a child, I was kind of left to my imagination, right? Which might be much worse than what it really was. Who knows? I don't know if anything could be much worse than what it really was. And as a child, I had a lot of questions about God, right? Is there a God? And if there's a God, how could God create a world like this? And if God is good, why is this world so bad? And I thought to myself, if I were born a couple decades earlier, then I would have been in a concentration camp. And then I thought, well, maybe I was in a concentration camp, and maybe I'm a reincarnated, relative, and all this stuff went through my mind. And I really had nobody to ask these questions to. The Hebrew school I went to, I didn't feel I could talk to these rabbis about these philosophical questions. And I didn't feel I could talk to my parents about it. And these questions really bothered me for quite some time in my life. Right? And it really haunted me up till high school. And then I heard a tape of a comedian that my father was a big fan of. He was a comedian psychologist. And I happened to hear this one line that he said, which is, as long as you keep laughing, you won't get an ulcer. So I thought, that's a philosophy of life. I'm not going to get answers to my questions, but I'm getting so stressed out over my questions, forget about the questions, go into comedy, right? And that's what I did, right? I decided to be the funniest kid in school, and everything was comedy, laugh, and he was right, right? If you keep laughing, you won't get an ulcer. I got a hernia. But I didn't get an ulcer. Right? Didn't get an ulcer. But at a certain point, these questions nag you. Yeah? The other way I would run away from questions was rock and roll. Was give me the Beat Boys, free my soul, want to get lost in your rock and roll and drift away. Rock and roll was the other answer to running away from my questions. And I would go to sleep at night to rock and roll. I would literally rock myself to sleep. I had these two huge speakers. I put my head between them, and I would listen to like heavy metal rock to go to sleep. Because when do those questions hit you? Very often at night. You know, when you're just about to doze off, and suddenly that little voice inside you, that soul voice starts to ask you, okay, so what's life really all about? And is there a God? And if there's a God, is this God interested in you? Right? And if this God is interested in you, is he an angry God? Is he a punishing God? Is he a judgmental God? And thank God, when I came to Israel, I met that fellow at the Western Wall, and he opened up an entire world of a whole new consciousness of what Judaism has to say about who you are, who I am, and who God is, and why we exist. And I want to share with you a little bit of the secrets that the Kabbalah shares. Now, I don't know about you, but when I grew up, I thought that God was a mean, angry, punishing God, right? And I remember when I was on the Larry King show, it was a show on spiritual health. There was Deepak Chopra. You're probably familiar with Deepak Chopra. Deepak Chopra has so many Jewish followers that in jest, rather than call himself Hindu, he calls himself Hinju. Okay? He's a Hinju. Okay? Marianne Williamson, who is a best-selling author who teaches a Christian-based course called The Course of Miracles. She's a Jewish woman, of course, right? So you got a Hindu and a Jew teaching Christian material. Then you had Billy Graham's son on the show and a fellow named Thurman who teaches Buddhism. So you can imagine how interesting the show must be. And I was the Jew representing Judaism. Start off the show. Larry turns to Deepak and says, Deepak, what's your definition of God? Right? And Deepak unloads this incredible metaphysical, esoteric description of the divine. The one, the infinite realm of possibilities. And I looked at him and went, oy vey. I was like very shocked by what he said. He was so polished and he was so sharp. Right? Then Larry turns to me and says, Rabbi, is he watching us? Is he judging us? You see, I get the bad rap for God, right? Is he judging us? So I say, well, Larry, of course God is certainly watching us, but he's not judging us, he's loving us. And there was this, like, shock on their face that I said this. Okay, then he turns to Marianne Wilson. Well, Marianne, what does God mean to you? She says, God is about love. And the whole story starts going off about this God about love. Now, the whole time I'm feeling really lousy, because I've said nothing intelligent whatsoever in front of 60 million people. I was hoping to say something intelligent, but I haven't said anything intelligent. We get to the commercial, first commercial. Deepak turns to me and says, Rabbi, I love your answers. I'm thinking, duh, like I've said nothing at all. Like I don't know what's in a love. I've said nothing interesting. Right? And then Larry says, Rabbi, you're doing phenomenal. You're doing wonderful. I'm thinking, what did I do? So smart. And I realized, you know what I did? I did something that was really unusual in their minds, and unfortunately I think in the minds of a lot of people, a lot of Jews, that I, as a rabbi, said, God loves us. And I've had people say to me, you know, Rabbi, that's very Christian what you're saying. Like, can you imagine that? If a rabbi say that God loves us, that's very Christian. Right? That's very Christian. And I've met Christians who say, you know, the difference between your God and our God, right? I don't know the difference because your God is Jewish, but okay. Right? But the difference between your God and our God, right, is your God is the God of law, but our God is the God of love. Interesting what they did in the name of that God of love, but we won't go there tonight, right? But a lot of Jews think that too. They think that Judaism is about a God of law, not a God of love. And I have to say, for many years of my life, certainly until 18, until I met that rabbi who taught me Kabbalah, that's what I thought. I thought God was a mean, angry, vengeful, punishing God. And I remember basically when I was a teenager, in my early teenager years, I went to a film, an underground film called Bambi Meets Godzilla. Wasn't very long film. Okay? Basically starts off with Bambi out in the field grazing, and there's this beautiful music in the background. La da 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 da. Bonk! And you see this huge foot of Godzilla stomp on Bambi, and that's the end of the film, right? So it's a 3-minute film, and then there's 20 minutes of credits, right? Bambi's makeup by, Godzilla's toenails by. And I wondered, isn't that an interesting name for a monster, Godzilla? Right? And I thought, you know, I think a lot of Jews think that when we were at Sinai, the first commandment was, I am Godzilla who took you out of Egypt so that you can now serve me, okay, and be my slaves. And when I was a child, I really, as I said, I struggled. What is with this God? Is there a God? And what does he want from me? And I remember I got for my, like, my fifth or sixth birthday a hamster, right? And being the little sadistical kid I was, I put my hamster through hell, right? I created all kinds of obstacles and difficulties for my hamster to kind of crawl through and squeeze through and jump through and fall through and whatever, right? And then one day it hit me that maybe this is why God created me. Maybe just as I was bored and I needed a pet, maybe God was bored and he needed a pet. So I have a hamster, and he has a humster, right? And just like I put my pet to hell, he puts me through hell, but I guess it's fair, right? Could you imagine, as a child, that's my philosophy on God, that I'm his pet, right? I'm his humster, and basically I've come into this world to suffer, and I guess I should be happy that at least I can be God's pet, okay? What I want to share with you tonight is a very different approach to God. And I want to approach this by using a very mystical story from the Talmud, okay? About who we are, what are the commandments, why did God create us, and what is God's expectation of us? The Talmud says that Moses went up to get the Torah, and he went into the angelic realm. The angels freaked out, because they see this old man huffing and puffing with a very bad stutter, right? And they say to God, who is this human being? Or what is this human being doing up here amongst us? So God says, oh, don't worry, he's not staying. He's just come to get the commandments. And then he's leaving. Well, that did not calm them at all. They said, what? The commandments? That treasure that you've been holding on to for 974 generations, you're going to give to him? So God says to Moses, Moses, you're going to have to deal with this. So Moses says, bah, 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 da, da, da. I mean, he stutters, right? He says, if I just open my mouth and they blow on me, I'm out of here, right? I don't even match up to their breath, right? I don't even have the substance of angel breath. So God says, we do have a problem here, but I'll give you a hint. Hold on to my holy throne, and that'll give you strength to respond to the angels, right? But you will have to present a case for mankind why human beings deserve the commandments. So Moses holds on to the holy throne. Suddenly he finds himself enveloped in this divine energy field. Now he feels strong, empowered, and he begins his case. He says, Master of the universe, what is it written in your Torah? What are these commandments? So God says, well, the first commandment is, I am God, your Lord, who took you out of Egypt. Ha! Moses says, angels, did you work under slavery and cruelty, horrifying oppression under the Pharaoh for 210 years? The angels say, heck no, we're angels, we live in La La Land, right? He says, well, we did. The angels are very confused by this. Moses says, God, what else is written in these commandments? Thou shalt not have other gods before me. Thou shalt not do idolatry. So Moses says, angels, do you live in idolatrous society? Now just bracket here for a second. You have to understand what idolatry was. Most people think idolatry were people bowing down to rocks and stones and figurines. That was only really the outside deception of what it really was about. Idolatry was the deification of nature. Idolatry believed that whatever comes natural to you is divine and okay. So if I naturally feel like killing you, and I can naturally get away with it, it's okay. Because it's natural. Nobody would in any way judge a lion for devouring a zebra. Like, that's okay, you're a lion, that's nature, that's fine. That's what those idolaters were. Do you know what was their essential form of worship to their idols? It was orgies, right? Their whole religious ceremony revolved around orgies. Believe me, it was not hard to get a minion, okay? Right? And the Talmud says that the Jewish people who became idolaters, they knew this was stupid, but it was fun, right? But they knew, philosophically held no water, right? But it was a great lifestyle. Fantastic kiddushes, right? So, you have to understand, what was idolatry? Idolatry is an incredibly alluring, seductive society. So when Moses says to the angels, angels, do you have the possibility of serving idols? Do you live in idolatrous society? And the angels say, no. Moses probably says, well, we do. Okay? So his case so far is, we have suffered for 210 years. And we live in a seductive, promiscuous society, constantly being challenged and seduced. Okay? Interesting argument. He then says to God, well, what else is written in your Torah? Thou shalt honor your mother and your father. He says, angels, do you have mothers and fathers? Do you have to go to therapy? They said, no. Right? So he said, well, we do. Okay. Fine. You know the story about these Jewish women that are bragging about their son, right? One says, my son, he loves me so much, he bought me a yacht. Nothing. My son loves me so much, he bought me a sports car. The other says, my son loves me so much, every week he goes and he just talks about me for an hour and he pays $200. That's how much he loves me. Right? So, you know, imagine, honor your mother and father. Do you have that challenge? No. Well, we do. What else is written in your Torah? Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not murder. Right? He says, do you have an evil inclination? Does jealousy exist amongst you? The angels say, no, we're perfect angels. So Moses proudly says, but we do. And the angels say, whoa, sorry. We didn't know who we were talking to. Okay, master of the universe, give them the commandments. That's basically the story with a little David Aaron embellishment. But basically that's the story. Now you gotta understand the story over here. It makes absolutely no sense. First of all, why did these angels want the commandments? What relevance would commandments have to angels? Right? Second of all, now don't get me wrong, I'm not necessarily suggesting we take this story literally. We definitely take the story seriously. Encoded in it is a message of who we are, who is God, and why we exist. Okay? So these angels don't seem to get what this was about, but then the argument of Moses is basically, angels, don't you realize who you're talking to? We are human beings who have suffered, who live in a seductive society. We are confused, messed up, tormented creatures filled with negative energies, yetzer hara, jealousy. That's your qualifications? Do you understand that basically Moses is saying, angels, do you know who you're talking to? You're talking to real lowlives, right? Do you know who you're talking to? You're talking about real messed up creatures. And they say, oh, we're sorry. Now we understand. Okay, so you can have the commandments. What are the commandments? And why are these the criteria? What kind of credentials are this that Moses says basically we're imperfect beings with challenges daily, complex, with evil inclination and jealousy? What kind of criteria and credentials are those to be proud of? So the key to understanding the story, understanding ourselves, is understanding what angels are. Right? Now, what are angels? Now, angels are pretty popular these days. You know, touched by an angel, right? And I think most people think angels are those little guys on wrapping paper. You know, the ones that are like this? You know, with the little things looking at each other, right? Those are not angels, right? I don't know what those guys are. But that's not angels. An angel is a force in the universe that acts as an agent for God. An agent. What is an agent? An agent is someone who has your power, who's given you the power of attorney to represent them and act on their behalf. That's an agent. Okay? Now I want you to understand a very deep idea. Why is it that the commandments are in the angelic realm? What were the sages communicating to us in this? Why is there this, so to speak, staged argument between angels that represent perfection and human beings that obviously represent imperfection? Okay? So the answer is this. Most people think that commandments are good deeds. Right? You know, you do them, you collect them, you save them, you cash them in the next world. I remember I was dating this girl, and I, you know, want to get a sense of who the person is and what their vision is. So I asked her, tell me, give me a vision of a day in the life of your home, right? So she said, well, when I close my eyes, what comes to my mind immediately is a mitzvah chart on the refrigerator door. Okay, that's sweet. I said, well, what else? And that was it. Then I got a little disappointed. Like that, I said, that's it? She says, well, you know, fine. Well, what's your image of your home? I said, I don't know, but when I close my eyes, I just think of a home filled with light. So she says, well, that'll run a pretty high electrical bill. I said, this is not a shidduch. this is not my besher for sure. Right? But I thought to myself, you know, I think there are people who actually think that God has a refrigerator, and on it is the refrigerator mitzvah chart, and of course he also has an oven, and in his oven is your transgression chart, and God is keeping score. Right? I want you to understand, that might work for children, and I'm not saying I wouldn't use that for my children, but somewhere in our process of evolution, we've got to realize that that's not what mitzvahs are really in the deepest sense about. A mitzvah, according to Kabbalah and this Talmudic piece, is a mission. A mission that when a person accepts a life of commandment, it means they are accepting the power of attorney of God being entrusted to them to represent God on earth. Right? This is an amazing idea. We've been put on earth with tasks, a mission to act on God's behalf. So if I see a poor person on the street, I could easily say, listen, you know, hey, God runs the world. And if this guy's poor, must have been in the stars, right? And if God wants him to have money, then God will find a way to get him money, and this has nothing to do with me. So that's the absolutely wrong way of thinking, right? The way of thinking is, wait a second, I've been given the power of attorney to represent God. I've been placed on earth with a divine mission to act on his behalf. This poor fellow needs money, and God has entrusted me with the mission to help this guy out. Okay? An amazing idea. Question is, why doesn't God do it himself? But we'll get to that in a second. But that's what the commandments are. The commandments aren't just good deeds that you know, you save and you collect. Every command is a task, part of the to-do list in our mission on earth. When a person accepts a life of commandment, they are accepting that the Creator of the universe is entrusting them with the power of attorney to represent God and act on his behalf. In other words, why does Moses go to the angelic realm to get the Torah? Because angels perform divine missions, and the commandments is a divine mission. Why did the angels say, what's going on, who is this man? Because they know that God has been holding on to this very special mission. They of course assume that one of the angels would be entrusted with this mission, and suddenly they see this human being show up, and he's going to be given this mission, and they can't figure this out. Doesn't make any sense, right? Why would a human being who's so fraught with mistakes and negative destructive energies and jealousy and complexities, why would that person be entrusted with this incredible mission that God has been holding on to for so long? So now, Moses has to present our credentials. What is it about us that makes us unique, that qualifies us for this very special divine mission on earth? So what are our qualifications? That we are filled with imperfections. That we are human. And that we make lots of mistakes. And that we live in a world that is filled with seductions. And that we have very negative energies, destructive energies. We are filled with jealousies. And that's what makes us so great for the job. That we're not so great. What makes us perfect for this mission is that we are imperfect. What's the mission? If you get this, it's an incredible paradigm shift on what we're doing on planet Earth. Right? What's the mission? The mission is that the Kabbalah teaches us that God wants to express a lofty type of goodness that is experienced and accomplished through challenge and choice. Now let's think about the different categories of goodness. Right? Let's say you have a fellow who is good, was good, is always good, has no inclination to ever do bad, and so they naturally do good. That's one type of person. Let's say another person whose inclination isn't naturally always towards good, has struggles, has challenges, but knows what is the right thing to do, overcomes negative energy and challenges, and chooses to do good. Which would be a higher form of goodness? Let me give you a specific example. I have a friend who, very hospitable, has for Shabbat, for every meal, 70 people, right? And he does not let his wife cook or clean for it, right? Now that's a tzaddik. One thing to say, hey honey, guess who's coming for dinner? That's easy, right? But he would start cooking like on Sunday, Monday for Shabbat to have his 200 and X amount of guests every week. Unbelievable man. So I said to his name, Rav Avram, I said, Rav Avram, you're amazing. You're so hospitable. It's like, I can't believe your achnasas orchim. Your incredible generosity. He says, it's really nothing. I love to do it. It comes natural to me, right? It's like some people sing in the shower. I love to just cook and clean for Shabbat and have people over. I love to do it. And that's beautiful. And he's doing a beautiful mitzvah and that's really wonderful. But let's say there's another guy, and we'll call him Josh. And let's say Josh is not such a social butterfly. I say Josh doesn't really have so much money. Let's say Josh doesn't really, you know, enjoy having people over. But he knows it's a commandment. He knows it's a very important mitzvah. And therefore, although it's not his natural inclination, he overcomes that. He rises to the challenge and he invites two guests over for Shabbat. Tell me, on the level of demonstration of goodness, right? Which would be an expression of a higher form of good? A good that simply comes naturally, and you never had any thought to do otherwise? Or a good that really is born out of a challenge, a struggle, a courageous choice, a commitment, persistence, and you do good? Right? I think we all intuit that that second form of goodness is a very high level of goodness. Correct? So here's the Kabbalistic question. Can God demonstrate that kind of goodness? God, who is perfect, gets it right all the time, surely doesn't struggle with any negative inclinations, doesn't struggle with any issues of being miserly. Can God demonstrate and express and bring into the world a goodness which is accomplished through rising to challenge, making courageous choices, and doing good? So the answer is yes, God can do that. You know how? By creating you and me. God created this imperfect world filled with lots of opportunities to do bad, and created in this world characters who are struggling, who are challenged, who are complicated, characters with a yetzer hara, with an inclination towards doing bad, and has given those characters the power of attorney to represent him, to choose goodness and bring into the world the manifestation of a goodness which is accomplished through challenge and choice. That's why we are here. This is an amazing idea. Because what this says is, if God wants to express this kind of goodness which is born out of choice and challenge, then He needs us. Then He needs to create beings that are imperfect, challenge complicated, put them in a world with plenty of opportunity to do bad so that they can do good and choose good. It's an amazing idea. Now we know the Talmudic story here. So Moses is priding himself, so to speak, bragging about how human beings are really not so great, not perfect, inclined to do evil. And the angels are impressed because angels don't have free choice. Angels can't express that kind of goodness, right? Only you can. So I want you to understand something. Jewish mysticism teaches us that each and every one of us is born in this world with a challenge. There's nobody in this world that doesn't have a challenge. And if you don't have a challenge, that's probably the biggest challenge, right? Not to have a challenge. But we all have a challenge. And every single one of us has what we call a yetzer hara. What's a yetzer hara? A negative inclination, right? A negative inclination. Some people, it's unbelievable what they would do for money, right? Some people can't figure it out. You would do that for money? You would stoop so low just for a buck? Right? Can't figure that out. I don't have that inclination, right? Some people, it's amazing what they would do for sex, right? Destroy their entire family, their whole reputation, right? Destroy people just because of their desire for sexuality. Others would say, I can't figure out why would I can't relate to that kind of negative energy. But there's such people. Some people, what they would do for fame, right? A number of years ago in one of the Olympics, right? If you remember the story, one of the girls that was in the skating, her brothers,
Tanya Harding.
Right? But, you know, their brothers went after the girl, the competitor, and broke her legs. Like, it's so important for you to have your sister win that you'd break someone. Can't figure that out. But what can I tell you? We're human beings are very messed up. We're a lot of negative stuff and tremendous potential to do tremendous evil. But that potential to do evil is precisely the potential to do good, right? If you can't choose evil, you can't choose good. If you can't choose hatred, you can't choose love. Now, could God choose hatred? No, it doesn't make sense to talk about a God who would hate, angels that would hate. The divine is perfect. But then, is there a possibility for love in the world? Could love be manifest? And so the Kabbalah says yes. The divine created a world, an imperfect world, which is the perfect setting for growth, for challenge, for choice, for goodness. And that's what the commandments are all about. Every commandment creates for us the opportunity to make a choice in our lives and perform a divine mission on God's behalf. And to me, this is one of the greatest teachings, that God needs you. Whatever situation you're in, whatever particular struggle you're dealing with, whether it's with a child, or whether it's with your spouse, or whether it's in business, whatever the particular challenge is, to grow, to improve, to demonstrate patience, compassion, love, right? To bring justice in the world and peace in the world, whatever it is, God is counting on you to bring that positive energy into the world. I once heard a Jewish philosopher put it so beautifully. What's the difference between a human being and an animal? Animals have needs, but a human being has a need to be needed. And when we feel we are not needed, then our whole life starts to fall apart. Right? And I think is a challenge for some people to get to a certain time in their life and they start to think, nobody needs me. Nobody cares about me. I can't offer anything or anyone anything in this world. Of what good am I in this world? Right? But Judaism brought to the world this incredible redeeming truth that every single one of us, if we're willing to accept the mission of choosing and bringing goodness into the world, God needs you. Right? Now you have to remember, it's a challenging idea and easily misunderstood, because God does not have to express this kind of goodness which is born out of choice. He doesn't have to, right? He doesn't need to. But once, so to speak, God chooses to express love which is born out of choice, love which is born out of choice, right? Goodness which is born out of choice, compassion which is born out of choice, then God needs to create a character in a world where the opportunity for hatred, for war, for evil is great, and inspirit that character with a spark of himself, the soul, right? And empower that person with the power of attorney to act on God's behalf and to choose goodness and grow, to choose love, to choose compassion. And that's why we're here on planet Earth. Why on Earth are we here? To make choices, courageous, positive choices to improve our lives, to improve the lives of our children, of our marriages, of our families, of our communities, of our city, of our country, world. That's why we're here. It's called Tikkun Olam. God intentionally created a world that is broken and put us in this world to fix the world. And that's why we're here. So in a nutshell, what is the secret life of God all about? It's about you. God's secret life is you. God is secretly, so to speak, participating in a world of choice through you and me by creating us in this world and inspiriting us, each and every one of us, with a spark of himself. According to Kabbalah, if God were the sun, each and every one of us would be a ray of his light. You are a ray of God. And you know what's even more important to know? The person sitting next to you is also a ray of God. And the person in front of you and behind you is a ray of God. And we've come in this world to make manifest a goodness that is born out of choice, love which is born out of choice, peace that is born out of choice. And when we do that, we experience the greatest joy to know that we have done something of great, great significance. Thank you very much.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.